Welcome to Beyond the OR with Dr. Kevin Brenner. I'm a board-certified plastic surgeon in Beverly Hills. I want to take you beyond my world of plastic surgery, diving deep into exciting hot topics and delving even deeper into compelling characters that I've met along the way. We'll be talking with attorneys, actors, comedy writers, Navy SEALs, and many other fascinating and inspiring people with truly intriguing stories to share. So let's jump right in. Welcome back to Beyond the OR. Today, I am very excited to have our guest with us, Mr. David Palmer. I've been trying to get David on our podcast since before we had a podcast because he's such an interesting guy. So David is a businessman, entrepreneur, and a testament to innovation and leadership. He's the founder of Bernoulli Lock LLC and a trailblazer of Web3 technology and tokenization, which is a lot of words that I don't totally understand. And that's why we're going to dive into it today, because I want to find out all about this. We're going to learn all about finance, venture capital, and what Web3 technology means to you and me. So David, welcome.
Welcome, David.
I've been avoiding you for about a year now. So.
I think longer. Longer than that. But yeah, I did say to you a while ago that I wanted to have you on, and your response was, I don't do interviews. Is that true?
That's pretty true. Although, I was a public company CEO and I did a lot of them, and that was kind of a necessary part of the job. I just never really enjoyed him an awful lot, but because I wanted to run the business, I wanted to be involved in running the business. But you have to be out there talking to your shareholders and telling your story all the time when you're in that role. And so I'm fine doing these things. I just was having fun toying with you.
truth be told, and I know this because I know enough about what you do. You don't really need to be doing my podcast, but you're doing it because I begged you. No, and
because he's throwing you a bone.
No, because I really enjoy talking to you, and I really think all the stuff that you've been involved with is so interesting, and that's basically the genesis of the show, is like what's super interesting that has nothing to do with what I do, right? So,
right.
David and I met initially. I took care of somebody that he knows, and that's how we met, and we sort of have been talking periodically. And initially, David is the first person that turned me on to Black Rifle Coffee.
Oh, right?
It has snowballed from there, because not only am I in the coffee club getting coffee regularly delivered to my house, I've turned and converted all my friends to Black Rifle Coffee.
Right.
I'm now a stock owner of Black Rifle Coffee, full disclosure. Coffee is really, really good.
Really good.
For those of you who don't know what Black Rifle Coffee is, it's a veteran-owned and operated coffee company based in Utah, I believe, right? And they have some brick and mortars, but it's mostly online dropship coffee, and it's really, really good coffee. You've had espresso at my house.
You made it
recently expanded to retail distribution. So Walmart is actually a very large customer now, and they'll be expanding that. And they basically have an omni-channel distribution strategy now. So online with the coffee club, which I'm also a member of, and I have bags and bags of coffee in the house. Although I actually don't drink coffee, but I'm a big believer in the ritual of coffee. You wouldn't want to see me caffeinated, I don't think. And
you wouldn't want to see me uncaffeinated.
And they have, some their own brick and mortar stores, about 25 or 6 of them or so. And it's a very authentic company. One of the reasons why we got involved early when they were a private company, and my investment group was the group that brought them public. Evan and Matt they're truly authentic people who truly, truly care about the veteran community. Over half of their team members are ex-vets, and they they don't have an outside peer agent. This is everything that they do is from their heart and soul, the service that they provided to the country, the service they provided to each other. And they truly are making a difference in impacting people's lives every single day. We brought the company public. We created a charitable trust alongside Black Rifle. We donated $5 million of our profit in the deal to it. The company donated it, and they organized themselves as a business purpose corporation. Actually, it's only the fifth publicly traded BPC that's out there. So they actually have uniquely a dual allegiance as a company. So the typical corporate structure, you have an allegiance solely to your fiduciary allegiance is solely to your shareholders. They actually have a primary a fiduciary responsibility to their shareholders and a secondary responsibility to their business purpose, which is actually improving the lives and helping the lives of veterans, first responders, and that community. So the foundation actually is one of the arms that allows the company to actually take a percentage of their profits and divert them to charitable causes that are impacting veterans' lives every day. And one of the reasons why we actually started talking early on, it's a very, very large population of traumatic brain injury folks that are in the community and amputees and paraplegics, and it's, you know, burn victims, and it goes on and on and on and on. The types of trauma that our vets and first responders have been exposed to in their line of duty to the country and to the citizens of the United States. And they're just doing everything they can to give back to that community. So it's great coffee, but it's a great purpose. It's a phenomenal group of men and women who run the organization, and their heart and soul is into it. So I'm very proud to be associated with it. I know that, you know, you've been a great supporter too. So anybody that's out there, you know, take a look. I think you'll A, you enjoy the coffee, but B, you also enjoy the culture and what they're doing as much.
It's super interesting. And I mean, Elizabeth knows this, and you and I have talked about it. I'm super interested in veterans organizations, and in particular, special operations community. And I try to learn as much as I can about it. Not only the good things, but the bad things. I actually just finished Matt's autobiography. Thank You for My Service, I think it's called, which is super interesting about his story.
Great title to a book.
In the Rangers, and then, you know, getting out and starting Black Rifle and all that. Hopefully one day we'll have him sitting in that chair where you are, because he's got a super interesting story. And quite honestly, everyone I've met from the special operations community has a super interesting story, and that's why I am always like, Elizabeth, we got to get this person on. But yeah, like the TBI thing, the traumatic brain injury, that's a real deal, and that's something that you were never in the military, correct?
No.
Have a passion for it, like I do.
Right. Yeah, and a lot of the folks that I've met and become really close to in the military, so I'm a number of ex-Navy SEALs, I met really through my son, Andrew, who suffered a traumatic brain injury from a race car accident 7 years ago. And some of the treatments that he was receiving were experimental and ultimately were adopted by the Veterans Administration as a proper protocol to treat TBI. He actually was a population of one. He was receiving Ambien actually as a stimulant, believe it or not. Some people who have TBIs have a paradoxical response to Ambien. And instead of putting the person to sleep, it actually has the exact opposite impact and actually brings them. And so at one point, Andrew was receiving 100 milligrams of Ambien a day.
You say 100 milligrams?
Milligrams a day.
Holy shit. That's a huge dose.
The highest documented dosage of any patient in the world, actually. But they used him as a study, presented the data to the VA, because the veterans are the highest TBI population in the world.
Yes.
Particularly, there's so many TBIs with the IEDs that they suffer, you know, in Iraq and in Afghanistan. And but it was not approved by the VA until they actually saw the data and the response that Andrew had to it, and particularly in the first year post his accident. He was in a coma for a month, and when he came out of the coma, it was very difficult for him to get any type of response. He was very kind of dissociated. And when he was given Ambien, he'd have 15 to 30 seconds of a delay, and he would instantly, I mean, after that 30 seconds, he would become very, very engaged, and it would last for, you know, about an hour or two.
Oh, wow.
So the VA now is using it as a treatment. And I think it's brought, you know, as you know, when you're rehabbing the brain, being aware and focused and rewiring circuits is an extraordinarily important part of that rehabilitation process. So the Ambien has been a gateway for some of these vets to be able to access focus and awareness, and allowing them to rewire, you know, their brain. So, you know, for Andrew, it was really a game changer. And I have met some vets along the way who've received the protocol. They're like, hey, there was some kid, you know. I said, yeah, that's my kid, right?
Oh,
yeah.
Wow.
So it's been been an amazing journey for us, as you know, as a family, and we've met some extraordinary vets along the way who benefited from it. And then as a result, you know, learn their story, and their stories are all amazing. They're all incredible. And I have there's one Navy SEAL that we've become very, very close to, Pete Scobell, who stays with us here in Wyoming and in our house in Malibu. And he has an incredible story now, is actually at USC getting his MBA. There's a special vet MBA program that USC has that is focused on people who've served in the military. And so the interesting thing is, I think there's a lot of folks in the community, both the education community, the medical community, the business community, who all understand the skills and the life experiences that these folks have are extraordinary. We can all learn from them. And we all, you know, I think have a bit of a duty and obligation to help them along the way. I mean, the reason why we're able to sit here and talk today is there's some people out there who are constantly, you know, willing to sacrifice their life and limb to give us this opportunity to speak freely to each other. So I'm a big, big fan and supporter of all the causes, right?
As am I. You kind of hit on it, but your company is based in Wyoming, correct?
Correct.
Just your current company.
And
you guys have a home up there, and that's where Andrew gets his rehab, right? There's
a big chunk. He has, you know, his primary rehab team is here. He has an extraordinary group of, you know, well, physical therapy, occupational therapy, speech therapy. His principal therapists are all here in Wyoming, but also it's just really amazing. His lead therapist here in Wyoming, Wendy Guido, her husband heads up the adaptive sports program at Jackson Hole Mountain Resort, Brian Guido, and they're just an extraordinary couple. And so Brian, you know, Andrew's a little bit of a canary in the coal mine. You know, he's skiing now, and he was a solid skier before the accident. This past season, his last 3 days, he was skiing fully on his own for a portion of each run. Brian, I ski on either side of him with a long pole, so he can kind of grab onto that pole. If we need to speed check him, we can pull that pole into his thighs and speed check him. And, you know, it's been a progression. You know, we started him, you know, 4 years ago, and when he was in a wheelchair still, and, you know, kind of progressed, you know, as he's progressed, and he's rock climbing weekly now, the Via Ferrata program here. Via Ferratas were developed basically in World War II. It literally means Iron Way. It was in the Italian Alps. They put rebar in rock and then a series of cables that you can clip into, so you can basically yourself belayed, but you can use the rebar as handholds. And they've become very popular now around the world and a lot of ski resorts for summer activities. So he's out there weekly. with Brian and with another guy, Giles, who kind of developed this climbing program. And you think about climbing, again, there's motor planning, there's problem solving as you try to think, okay, which route am I going to take? So it's very, very good, both from a cerebral standpoint and a physical standpoint. And I think as you probably are aware, you can combine, particularly brain rehabilitation, you can combine physical and some type of cognitive load together, you get a much better outcome. So Andrew's doing that here as well. So we do have a great team also in Southern California. So when we are in Southern California, we have a great physical therapist, and Dustin's gotten Andrew involved in boxing. So Andrew's boxing 3-4 days a week when he's in Southern California at Churchill Boxing Club, which is actually a pro gym, and it's great. And he trains, his trainer there is Pedro, whose principal job is actually training young professional boxers, but he's developed a great relationship with Andrew. So boxing has become a big part of his rehabilitation, as is Hipple therapy, which we do in Southern California. Hipple therapy is a branch of physical therapy. So these are physical therapists who then get additional training to work with horses. And a horse's gait is very similar to the human gait from a balance shift standpoint, a cadence standpoint. And so when you put a patient on a horse and you're doing specified riding skills, sometimes you're riding without touching the horn or the saddle, your brain is getting the same wiring, all the micro movements of keeping your body, you know, from toppling over, right? There's all micro adjustments that the body does when it's shifting weight from gait to gait. So in a typical hippo therapy session, you'll get about 4,000 horse steps in during a session. Well, for, you know, a TBI patient like Andrew, he couldn't get close to doing 4,000 steps in a treatment session. So his brain is actually getting in his upper body, is getting wired as if he's taking 4,000 steps. And I'd say hippotherapy has been one of the most profound treatments that he's received, because it's an intense brain circuitry, you know, wiring that's going on, and he's getting that. And from a balance standpoint, posture, think about just the posture, starting to walk and then stopping so you don't fall over, right? There's all kinds of muscular, you know, neuromuscular pathways that need to be refined in order for that to occur. It's very, very complicated task.
Wow.
So a combination of
he sounds busier than me, Andrew.
He's hardcore. I mean, as a race driver, he was, you know, traveled all over the world racing and you know, very, very dedicated athlete, both from a training standpoint and from a just a physical. He was specialized in endurance racing. So he's taking that same you know, passion and dedication to his therapy schedule. So yeah, he is very busy, pushing constantly. And that's one reason why he's met a number of folks, you know, Navy SEALs along the way, and they, you know, it's you probably being around folks that are in the military, particularly those who have been injured, you know, there's a certain gallows humor and abuse that they all have. They are just abusive to each other as far as, you know, you're not working hard enough. You know, I don't care if you're missing a leg, you got to run faster. I mean, it's like, it's something you understand if you're in the community, if you're from outside the community. I mean, people see, you know, sometimes my relationship with Andrew and pushing him, and he'll walk into the boxing gym and they're all trash talking him and, you know, tell them they're going to take him down. And you're like, holy cow. But it's just part of how they heal, right? It's you're using humor and you're using grit in as part of your healing process. So
it's part of their ethos, though. I mean, it's the never quit mentality, which
right. So, you know, race car drivers had that same kind of, you know, they're living constantly with, you know, with death and injury as kind of part of their daily routine. And unfortunately, Andrew was on, you know, the bad end of that, as some of these folks in the military. So they all kind of have. They bind together kind of around that, and they rally around you know, kind of overcoming this new deficit that they have in their life. And you've probably never been around some of the most positive, I mean, some of the most positive people are the folks from that community. And you see Andrew and his impact when he walks into the rehab centers, you know, he lights up the place because people see his determination just to walk, right? And he used to challenge us. There's this really cool actor in LA that was doing some rehab with Andrew. They would have these races. He had a stroke, and I won't name his name just to pretend. I'm not sure if he wants, you know, people to know about it or not, but just a fantastic man that we've gotten close to. And he and Andrew would just challenge each other to race the hobble down the hallway. Right. You know, he was, and it was funny and sweet and at the same, and sad and tragic all combined, but, you know, to see them push each other, right, was pretty extraordinary. So that's, you know, kind of been the last 7 years of my life is being around all these phenomenal people overcoming, you know, these issues and deficits in their life and turning them into, I mean, this actor actually, his career, you know, people are over, but he actually reintroduced, you know, himself to the world and actually played this, a stroke patient in a very, very popular series. And he's done some very amazing things. Right. So it's been a crazy journey for us.
That's awesome. So, and that's all, that's primarily up in Wyoming and down here, but you're originally, right. Aren't you originally from Chicago?
Right. So the kids, the three children were all born and raised in Chicago,
my old stomping grounds.
And, you know, Andrew went through all the way through high school there, University of Chicago Laboratory High School, and my second child daughter Allie went through all the way through high school there, and then me and my youngest went partly through high school there. And then when we were getting Andrew treatment, he went to a neuro clinic shortly after, so about a year after. So Andrew was in a coma for a month in the hospital for about another 6 months. And then we found there was a neuro clinic that was in Encino, California, Center for Neuro Skills. And we brought Andrew out as a kind of a temp thing in the summer of 2017. And he responded very, very well to their treatment modalities. So we had him do treatments there for a while. So
is that, that's how you made your way out to LA? Or were you, were you guys kind of partially there?
I had bought a house out there to get out of the doghouse because of that house in Wyoming, you know, with Chicago and Wyoming, cold, right?
Right.
And my wife was kind of like, maybe we should have something a little bit warm. So,
people didn't understand when I left Los Angeles. Yeah, I grew up here. When I left LA to head to Wisconsin and then Chicago, they're like, "What's wrong with you? Why would you possibly want to go to the Midwest?" But the Midwest is awesome. It's just really cool.
We know the kids, we grew up in this. We still actually have our house in Chicago. We don't visit. I've only been there twice in the last 7 years. Very, very happy in Wyoming. I love Wyoming. Wyoming is extraordinary. And, you know, it was a great city, you know, to raise the kids and, that, you know, great schools and it unfortunately has had a very, very tough go the last, you know, 5 to 10 years. There's been a substantial decline, I think, in the city, and it's unfortunate, and that's why, you know, I don't really go back there an awful lot.
And the crime anymore. Is off the hook.
Yeah.
It's terrible. It was bad when I was at Cook County Hospital for my general surgery trauma training.
A very, very good friend of mine. So, you know, I never went through this with you. So if you met, what years were you at Cook County?
I graduated med school in 97. So 97 to 2002. I was at Rush in Cook County.
Did you meet Dr. Pat Dunn? Then he was an interventional radiologist at Cook County for years.
At that time? It's possible. I mean, I spent most of my nights in the interventional radiology suite.
He actually headed up. He was the head or co-head of the interventional radiology department at that time.
Yeah, those guys worked as hard as
any rotation through, you know, any of the departments that, you know, he probably would have been along the way. So, yeah, and Cook County is, you know, there's some extraordinary people that work at Cook County, but it's, you also see, you see the worst of,
oh my God,
the human condition there. And it's gotten worse. It's really bad,
but it's excellent training. It really, the training is still today. It's amazing.
So David, you are incredibly diverse in what you do, and you have a background in physical chemistry.
Yes. Yes. It's just one of those things that kind of happens. So I was a lot, and I was in the math and science. Get to college, you take a placement exam. They place you in this advanced chemistry course, and there's 20 of you in it, and you kind of feel special. And then you have to make a decision.
And you went from there to business.
Well, you have to make a decision. Do you do physical chemistry or do you organic chemistry? And I love physics, and physical chemistry is the physics of chemistry. So for some crazy reason, four of us decided to go the physical chemistry path, which was, it's probably, you know, the most fun and the least fun I've ever had in my life. Meaning the most fun. I learned my senior year, it was probably the best academic course I've taken in my life. Took an entire semester on quantum theory.
Oh, and love quantum theory.
And in quantum theory, you learn about the duality of nature. You learn that an electron can occupy two states simultaneously, and you can mathematically solve for that. And we spent the entire semester rotating. There was only four of us in the class, so the professor would give a lecture, and these were an hour and 45 minutes. I'm sorry. The lecture was an hour. Then you have an hour of Q&A. So you had to be disciplined to be able to prepare a lecture about a pretty weighty subject. And we rotated. So every fifth lecture I'd have to give. And there's nothing more difficult than trying to figure out how to articulate a difficult, you know, scientific.
It's hard enough to take the class, right?
Then have to withstand an hour of Q&A from your classmates who wanted to basically embarrass you in front of the class.
So, take it down.
But it was fun, right? Because then you got your chance to do it right in the next class. But I learned an awful lot about the scientific method, about presenting ideas, about organizing your ideas, about withstanding Q&A, kind of hostile Q&A, in good nature, but hostile Q&A. from a group of folks that you really respected. I mean, my classmates were all, you know, bright fellows. And so it was a great preparation for anything really in life. It was more philosophical preparation. I think once you accept that an electron can occupy two states simultaneously, and that, you know, your sense of absolutism and all those things, kind of you understand that there's gray in life, and that it's all about probabilities. You view the world a lot differently. So it did prepare me about high risk management. All that, I think, was really influenced by my study of the physics of chemistry. And then you have, you know, a professor that really had a big impact. I mean, he realized that I really didn't like it. You know, my other classmates were really into it. They wanted to professionally pursue, you know, a life in that area. And I didn't, but I was running kind of all of the business of the entertainment at the school. So all the concerts and anything that had to do with fun or music.
not physical chemistry.
Chemistry, but I was in the lab, and my chemistry advisor at the time, Dr. Robin Kinnell, was extraordinary. You know, he said, you know, have you thought about business? Because you clearly don't like chemistry. I mean, you kind of go through it, you're engaged, but I can see that's just not really where your head is. But boy, you're like doing all these other things. And I don't really, you know, I came from my father's a dentist, my mom was a nurse, and I grew up in a neighborhood with kind of doctors, and my best friend's father was a businessman. That was my only real exposure to business. And I didn't even know what an MBA was. So there was another economics professor at school, and I had received an award, and he was kind of like the faculty advisor to this group of us. And so between my chemistry professor and this faculty advisor, they said, you should go take the GMAT and apply to graduate business school. I'm like, I didn't know what it was. What are you talking about?
Oh my God.
So they, you know, they said, well, you got to go sign up and you got to go take the GMAT. It was like 2 weeks away. And back, we didn't have prep courses. They just kind of like,
you just jumped into it.
They just jumped into it. So I took the GMAT and I applied to schools. And I was fortunate. You know, you never know. But this, I tell this story quite a bit because you just never know. So I was young for college for my class, and I was way too young to be applying to graduate business school. Most people back in the 80s, I graduated from college in 83, would go work for years and you'd apply to school. So so a lot of schools wouldn't give me an interview.
I think they still, it's business they schools still, that way. Absolutely. Yeah.
So I just was like, they weren't, you know, willing to give me an interview. You know, back then we didn't have email. Back then you make phone calls. So I convinced University of Chicago and Kellogg, Northwestern, to give me an interview. What was what I thought was going to be an interview. So I flew out to Chicago. I go to University of Chicago first, and I get to the interview, and they said, why are you here? I said, well, you gave me an interview, and it was a total miscommunication. They thought, they didn't realize I was a senior in college. They said, look, we'll talk to you, but this is not an official interview. He says, we do not give interviews to seniors in college. So it was a total miscommunication. I had spoken to somebody who had scheduled it. So they said, look, you know, we'll see it in 2 years. You can apply in 2 years. Well, and I was very dejected after that. And then, so I'm thinking, it was the same thing that happened to me at Northwestern. That night in Chicago, there was an extraordinary storm, a rainstorm, and lightning came and hit, and it knocked a tree down in Evanston. And the person that was supposed to come and interview me couldn't make it to Northwestern that day. So I got there because there was no email, no communication. I didn't know that this was the interviewer was not able to interview me. So I get there and I'm soaking wet. I remember just soaking wet. I'm sitting in there. I said, well, I had scheduled this interview. I flew in all the way from, you know, upstate New York for this. And they said, well, nobody's here to interview. I said, however, the dean of students, Dean Wilson, I'll never forget him. He's here and he can talk to you. So I said, well, I'll talk to him. So I go in to speak with the dean of students, and he apologized about the miscommunication. He starts with a speech, you know, we don't normally interview seniors in college. And I said, look, he said, you know what? He said, I got nowhere to go. The power lines are now down. It's like it's a whole mess outside. He said, you flew all the way here. He said, tell me your story. So he gave me a chance to tell my story, why I felt I should be in business school. And he listened. He gave me kind of an hour to talk, and he asked me questions. And at the end of it, he said, you know what? He said, it's totally unorthodox, but I'm going to pound the table for your candidacy.
Oh, my God.
So he said, you know, you're going to be one of the youngest kids if you get accepted. So I applied it they did defer me for, cause I was young. I was only 20, and they deferred me for a year. So just go do something in the world, you know? And so, so I showed up in the fall of 84, but if it wasn't for that tree falling down and, you know, the dean, you know, Dean Wilson kind of feeling sorry for this sopping wet kid who his interview had just been canceled. You know, that would have, you know, my course may have been different. I probably would have still ended up going to business school, but not probably, you know, in that time at that class. So things happen. And I always say to people, you never know. Always take the meeting if you get a meeting, right? You know, tell your story. Don't be afraid to tell your story.
So. But it's crazy how one interaction with one person can change the trajectory of your life. Like one decision.
One decision, right. I mean, he
one decision can change your trajectory. Like for me, that was going to Wisconsin. Like that changed my trajectory. If I had gone to UC San Diego like I was planning, I wouldn't be sitting here. I probably never would have gone to medical school. Who knows?
Yeah.
But right. And then you ended up at Kellogg, right?
Right up at Kellogg, yeah. Right. And I loved it. You know, it really was that. Where physical chemistry, it was, intellectually challenging for me, but it was just not a passion at all. And I did it, and I loved graduate business school, and I loved the experience at Kellogg and what I was learning. And so it was really my awakening, both from an academic standpoint and just what I was able to kind of get involved with and what I was able to, you know, do there. So, so that was for me, again, one of these trajectory changes. So if it wasn't really for, by the way, if I hadn't selected physical chemistry and been somewhat miserable in it, right? My advisor probably wouldn't have noticed, right? He probably said, okay, just another guy that will try to help, you know, with a scientific career. He probably wouldn't have then, you know, introduced me to, you know, to the concept of graduate business school. And then if it wasn't for a tree falling down, you know, do I end up at Kellogg, in the class of, you know, entering in the fall of 84?
No coincidence.
You may have ended up in medical school or something.
Yeah.
Right. Well, you know, that was my original thought was to go to medical school. You know, that was my reference point, right?
It was smart of you not to.
My mother was very prescient. She knew that I would be a horrible doctor. She just,
you're like, thanks, Mom. Right.
And so they arranged for me to get an externship, not an internship, but an externship of my sophomore year in college, freshman or sophomore year in college. My very, very first day on the job, they put me in the ER, and my very first 15 minutes, I witness a person dying of cardiac arrest.
Oh my God.
I have to wheel the person to the morgue. That kind of
that was the end of that.
That's dumb luck.
I'm so depressed. And it was the thing that really I didn't realize the person had died. What happened was you know how those things, you know, impact human life. So people walked in, they were talking about strawberry shortcake in the cafeteria before this code, whatever the code is for a cardiac arrest, you know, came on. And they were just chit-chatting, and all of a sudden, no code, whatever, guy comes in, they try to resuscitate him, and then he died, but I didn't realize the person had died, because all of a sudden, everybody starts shutting everything down. They walk out and start talking about strawberry shortcake. And finally somebody said to me, like, he's dead, right? And get him, you know, to the morgue. And it just impacted me that I could not fathom dissociating myself. You know, you need to compartmentalize massively if you're going to be, I think, a great ER doctor. And these folks were able to compartmentalize. And I just remember just, you know, going home and just, I couldn't sleep the entire night. I was so traumatized by the whole thing. So,
You wouldn't have done well in anatomy. We used to, cause I was at Loyola in Maywood, and we used to, our gross anatomy, the cadaver course.
Oh my God. We
would go every morning, and then like right when we were done in our class, it was lunchtime. So like we would all go from the cadaver lab to the hospital cafeteria reeking of formaldehyde.
Oh my God. Right?
And can you imagine like you're visiting your family in the hospital and you go to get a bite to eat in the cafeteria, and there's like 40 medical students and they all smell like a cadaver. I mean, it was terrible.
I can't even get my blood drawn without passing out. So can't even imagine. But wait, we're going to run out of time. So we got to get into this fan fact.
So Kellogg. And then since then, it's been like one entrepreneurial endeavor after another, right? You started in resort management with Diamond Resorts. Am I getting that right? And then it's just been like kind of one successful company after another, and you just keep.
And that was, you know, from a trend from that into this, into what I'm doing right now with FanVest. So it's worth just a short summary, because the Diamond Resorts deal was kind of a culmination of a lot of different skills. It was a highly troubled company. I worked with a group to take, it was a public company that had been delisted, a group to take them private. I was the CFO at the time. And I'm going to do a full gut rehab of that business and restructure it and turn it into something that was focused on the customer. It wasn't focused on the customer. It was really, it was just, had good bones, but it had all kinds of issues. And so I can do an entire kind of segment about, again, you know, kind of taking the meeting, but we were able to restructure that business around customer experience and the customer journey. We did 10 acquisitions of other troubled businesses. We were able to bring them in, and we grew that business substantially. We took it public, and as a public CEO, and we brought it from 100-ish million of EBITDA to $460 million of EBITDA in 4 years, and then sold it, actually negotiated the sale of that business to bring it back private to Apollo Management while Andrew was actually, I was in the ER, he was in his coma.
Oh, and we God. Had,
so, you know, it was a pretty traumatic time, but, and then I had the decision to make whether I was going to stay with that business. They wanted me to stay or retire. So I elected to retire and stay with Andrew and his rehabilitation journey. But I learned so much about two things in that. One was that experiences massively turned our business from a cynical business. Because, you know, we had a management company, but a member management company, with timeshare operations, with hotel operations. The timeshare piece was such a cynical piece of the business, and we were able to turn that into something with unbelievably high customer satisfaction, because we did it around these amazing journeys. And one of them we did around sports. So we had a whole sports vertical where we did these immersive 3-day weekends. We had a partnership with the Yankees and with the San Francisco Giants, and we did these immersive baseball weekends. And I learned how experience that was unique and different, what I call sausage making, kind of behind the scenes, really impacted people. And then when Andrew was coming out of his coma, he had no short-term memory at all. He had about a 1 second memory. And one of the doctors said, you need to engage him in things that he really likes and he's passionate about. And it will help potentially start to wire a short-term memory into a long-term memory. And I said, well, geez, you know, because you're a kind of a helpless father, right? When your son is so injured. I said, well, this is something. Well, that's my roundhouse, right? I just spent the last decade of my life, you know, organizing and creating an entire enterprise that grew substantially around experience. So I decided that, okay, I could do that for Andrew. And I started doing it for Andrew. And we started engaging him in art and music and things that he loves and cars. And sure enough, he started to be able to hold a memory. And the first thing that we did with him was he loved Land Rover Defenders. And so I bought a Land Rover Defender from England, brought it over. And I said, we'll redo this. And I went to him. This is about 8 months after the accident. He couldn't hold the memory at all. I asked him to pick the color. He picked the color Keswick Green. And then the day after I did that, I asked him, I said, you know, we're going to do this Land Rover Defender 110. And do you remember the color you saw? And he remembered the color.
Oh, wow.
Oh, wow.
It just blew my mind. It was like the only time he'd been able to hold anything for more than, you know, an hour or so. So I decided ultimately, you know, that not only did, you know, I ran a company and it was very successful. We created a lot of value for all of our shareholders. I'm now was impacting Andrew. I've been toying with this idea of next generation membership. And so I decided to kind of found a company that was kind of in honor of experience and honor of what I'd experienced with Andrew and experience at Diamond Resorts. And I can go for a long story on Bernoulli Locke, but I won't just mention that Bernoulli's principle is one of our favorite principles. It's also the thing that kept Andrew alive. The ventilator that works in a Venturi, which is Bernoulli's principle. And so that Bernoulli's principle kept Andrew alive when he was in his coma.
Physics.
And John Locke is the philosopher that said we are the sum of our experiences. So that's the story behind Bernoulli Locke. And I was looking for next ways, generation ways to engage consumers around experiences. And I realized that Web3 and blockchain in particular gave us very efficient ways to create transparent relationships with folks. In probably the most efficient way. We spent $50 million at Diamond creating our customer IT management system, right? And we had 200,000 people kind of in our flagship membership. there. And I wanted to be able to do something that could create trust and transparency, governance and ownership on a much more cost-effective basis. And I started looking at using Web3 as really the mechanism for doing that, because if something is a public blockchain and therefore you have absolute transparency, you can transact in a very efficient way with somebody where you don't have to spend huge amounts of time trying to prove the legitimacy of that transaction, right? And reps and warranties and legal, right? So a public blockchain, which is what Web3 really is.
So can you explain that, dumb it down for me? Because I have a very limited range of my knowledge base.
All a blockchain is doing is basically in a public verifiable fashion, recording that in effect permanently, right? So that it can be viewed and verified. And when you think about all these people that are mining, right? All they're doing is they're verifying transactions and they're being rewarded for that verification process by receiving a digital currency. But so the base core technology of public ledger is really powerfully transformative, because most of what we do in a transaction is there's all kinds of time, energy, and effort spent trying to convince the other party of A, your legitimacy to enter into that, the fact that you have the good or the service, and then B, their legitimacy to actually enter into the counterparty of that transaction, right? So you have, if you think about a contract to sell a business and the thousands and thousands and thousands of pages and the representations and warranties that each side have to make and then for it to actually then occur and it's really a cumbersome process, but blockchain, to simplify it, allows all parties to view and to verify in what we call a trustless transaction, where we don't actually have to know each other, because it's going to be and it cannot be reversed. It's going to be recorded on this public ledger that can be actually audited by any third party around the world. So you take that as a premise for interacting with strangers, like how do you build kind of a community of folks that don't know each other, which is what we did at Diamond, 200,000 people from around the world. We were in 14 countries, 110 different locations. So we spent all this money, right, to be able to build a system that created kind of that trust. Well, you can do it now in a relatively simple transaction, because they don't need to necessarily trust you, or I don't need to trust them, by the fact that we actually are willing to actually enter into a transaction that's recorded permanently in the blockchain. It takes all that friction of trust away. So I knew that we would be able to utilize the technology. Now, NFTs and crypto were really derailed, and this is where I think me being a gray-haired former CEO of a publicly traded company comes in. There was a belief by a lot of the early crypto adopters that these were not securities, that these kind of sat outside of the regulatory framework that had governed, capitalism in the United States, for the last century. And there was people who truly, they were just naive, or maybe they were just hopeful and wishful. So, NFTs, people sort of feel, oh, this is, or in various digital currencies, that these were ways, kind of a new way to kind of finance business and to kind of, circumvent SEC regulation. And I recognize that was not the case. So when we decided to launch FanVest, we stood up, raised our hands, said we're 100% in disagreement with the crypto community on that conclusion. We believe that these are securities and that it fits the true definition of a security. So we decided to launch FanVest around a purely regulated, securities protocol. And, at first, I think we had a number of arrows in our quiver from, I think, the crypto community saying, well, wait, you're kind of against what we're doing. I said, no, we're just living in the reality of regulation, and the SEC is going to accept what we're doing, and they're going to reject kind of what you're doing. You can see that right now. The SEC is litigating with a number of folks that did some of the original NFT communities and some of the initial tokens, saying, no, those were securities, and you were in effect selling an unregistered security. So we decided to marry the benefit of blockchain, which is really a very efficient way to enter into trustless transactions, right, where you don't necessarily trust each other, but you can create trust through transparency. with all the experience I had with creating experiences that impacted people's lives around sport, around entertainment, and married those two worlds to try to create the first ever fan-owned and governed professional sports team. We were able to work with SailGP. They changed their entire participation agreement. SailGP was founded about 3.5-4 years ago by Larry Ellison of Oracle. And
they're based in UAE. Is that right?
No. So SailGP is, well, technically, they're legally a U.S. company. Their headquarters are in London. The team, the CEO, their operations are headquartered in London, but they are a global racing series that takes around the world. And they do have a race in the UAE. They were in Dubai last year. They'll be in Abu Dhabi this year. 12 races that North America, Australia, New Zealand, Bermuda, Italy, France. I'm actually leaving for Saint-Tropez on Wednesday, going to the race in Saint-Tropez, France, Spain. So Canada's racing Canada. So it's a global league. They were willing to listen to what our vision was. They had a vision also. They wanted to be innovative and they were interested in allowing one of their teams to be fan owned and controlled. So we're doing the first ever fan owned. So we're basically fractionalizing a limited liability corporation with tokens.
Do they do that in Germany also and Spain? Don't they have some sports teams that are owned by the fan?
Well, yeah, they're kind of partway to where we're going.
Right.
We actually are fully recognized as a participation agreement with the league of how the governance actually will work with the fans. So we actually have not only from an ownership standpoint, we have a full governance structure that's being we're utilizing Web3 technology there as well. So all of our voting, all of our governance is fully transparent to everybody. So there's no hidden anything. Our budget is fully transparent. Any transaction over $500,000 actually gets approved by our community. And so we're taking it to kind of the next kind of evolutionary level of full fan ownership and governance.
So apart from the token aspect of it, it basically the same idea as the Green Bay Packers, where
so Green Bay Packers is the intellectual precursor to this. You don't actually have true economic ownership and governance with the Packers. You have a certificate basically in the trust you have no true right to cash flow distributions and governance and voting the way, you know, ours are. So, you know, that was a very interesting innovation. It was back in the 20s that, you know, the Congress gave them a special carve out to do that transaction. They actually utilized it twice to raise capital. But it doesn't have the ownership and governance features. Ours is true ownership. You have a fractionalized direct economic portion of the LLC, and the governance, you have a direct vote.
So the advantage for the existing team owners is to raise capital in this manner.
Yeah. So, you know, from our standpoint, what we wanted to do is really democratize access to ownership, and in sports in particularly, but you're seeing this across, you know, media and entertainment as well, and collectibles, access to ownership rights has pretty been much, you know, precluded because it's really become, I mean, who would have thought that the Phoenix Suns would trade for $4 billion and the last round of the LA Lakers was valued at $7 billion. So it's really quite rarefied air, and there's only, and the world is only has so many billionaires that can stroke those types of checks. So we knew that there was going to be an opportunity to democratize access by allowing a much larger group. In our structure, we can do up to 2,000 people that are accredited investors, and then we can do another sleeve that is an unlimited sleeve, but capped at just $5 million of not accredited investors. So we're going to be able to provide access to, you know, many thousands of people in the, in an ownership structure in professional sports that's never been done before. Now,
that's so interesting.
Evolution, like the NBA last year changed its participation agreement to allow up to 20% of a team to be owned by private equity. And private equity, in effect, is a fractionalized. So you have a general partner, then you have limited partners. So it's the first kind of evolution towards fractionalized ownership, because they recognize that to create liquidity for the owners, you know, they would want to be able to potentially sell a portion of the teams to more institutional investors. So the NBA is, I think, will be the next, and we definitely have desired to have an ownership position in an NBA team using the structure. And you'll start to see other sports leagues toy with this type of structure, or quasi, there are other kind of public and publicly traded structures, but it's going to have to happen, because as you start, you know, routinely getting teams that are in the $5 to $8 billion valuation ranges, the ownership, and also the, from a stability standpoint, the leagues are going to want to have stable capital structures that are in place governing these teams.
So as well. Last follow-up question on this, and then, because we're like way over time, unfortunately, but because I could talk about this for a long time.
For a long time.
But, you can edit it down.
So what is the risk then to the token buyer? Like, let's say I call you, I'm like, I want to buy $5,000 token. Is there any financial risk apart from the purchase of that token?
Yeah. So that's the beauty of what we're doing. So there's no risk from a regulatory standpoint, because it's a registered, regulated security that you're purchasing. The risk is, like any other, common equity, any other risk capital asset, right? Is that, you know, the team could do well and financially, the team could not do well financially, and therefore you can either, you know, make money on the economic fortunes of the team or the economic perils of the team. So the risk is the risk for any other investment that you make, right? But we don't pile on additional risk of there's some type of securities issue, or, you know, that's why we were, and that's why, by the way, you know, SailGP was willing to give us a participation agreement. I mean, the last thing that Larry Ellison wanted was to have a team that had all kinds of securities issues. You know, he's, you know, a public figure, and you know, his wealth is with Oracle, which is a publicly traded corporation. So he understands this issue as well as anybody. And I think that's one of the reasons why they're willing to do this, is that's my framework for this. And our team has worked very, very hard, you know, with SailGP to make sure that we're 100% compliant with all the SEC regulations.
And where, could you tell our listeners, because we're going to have to wrap this up, where they can participate on FanVest and get more information?
Sure. Yeah. So if they go to FanVest, FanVest, FanVest.io, all the information is there. They'll see it. So our first project is this fan-owned SailGP team. There's links to it and all the proper disclosures, the private placement memorandums, all that kind of stuff is at FanVest.io.
Okay.
Yeah.
Perfect. Awesome. Dr. Brenner, why don't you ask your last closing question?
My last question. I have more questions, but we can't do it.
No, we can't do it. We have another guest. So, we can talk all day.
David, I always ask everyone, and there's nothing to sweat about, but if you had not gone to business school and gone into business and been entrepreneur, et cetera, what do you think you would have done with your life career trajectory? Clearly not medical school, right?
Yeah, not medical. Well, I think, you know, from a business standpoint, you know, I've always been very focused on, and I think, you know, the enabler to my entire life journey has been education, you know, and so I'm a big believer in education. I'm not indoctrination, but education, right? I'm a big believer in free speech. I'm a big believer in exchange of ideas and scientific method. I'm a huge, huge believer in the scientific method. So I would probably be involved in some level of, well, I don't know if you call it academic, but, you know, I do enjoy the pursuit of knowledge you know, is I mean, I'm constantly in pursuing every single day in pursuing knowledge, right? Every day. So to me, just my pursuit of knowledge has just been in business. But so it could have been, whether it was scientific or whether it was academic or something, it would have been a knowledge based pursuit for sure.
Awesome.
Well, David, I got to say, when I read your bio and all your information, like I wrote to Dr. Brenner and I put David Palmer, wow. Impressive, impressive. And thank you so much.
Could you please tell my family?
I will tell them, yes.
I'll send them the text.
Send them the text. I would like for them to believe that at some point. Yeah.
You know, your family never understands it like the people that you work with, right?
That's fine. I love the fact that my family doesn't find any wow factor in me.
But they should. They probably do. They probably just don't tell you as much as you need to hear it, right? Well, David, thank you for indulging us. I appreciate your time, especially on Saturday. It's always nice to see you and always enjoyable to talk to you.
When I get back to Southern California.
I hope to see you on your next trip out here.
Thank you, David.
Thank you very much.
All right, okay, take care.
Okay.
Thanks so much for listening to Beyond the OR with Dr. Brenner. Make sure to subscribe, like, and follow so you don't miss any future episodes. In the meantime, hit me up on Instagram, Twitter, and TikTok @KevinBrennerMD and KevinBrennerMD.com.